from deep inside your radio.
Meet Harry the Swinger. He's one of those people who likes to keep active, plays a lot of golf, likes the theater, the beach, and goes dancing almost every Saturday night. But Harry didn't always swing.
No, yes, I did. And thanks very much, the late Ernie Anderson. Ladies and gentlemen, what a beautiful Sunday it is. It's a Sunday kind of Sunday, don't you think? And I'd like to thank the Academy. And definitely heartfelt congratulations on the forthcoming new TV deal for the award show. I think Spike is a great outlet. The question I was left with, nobody raised this in the whole discussion this week. I've changed subjects now. The whole big sports foo-foo that occupied the late part of this week. What's Delonte West going to do now? Nobody. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of AFPAC. AFPAC! The U.S.-Pakistan partnership, critical in addressing global terrorist threats, say some, is threatened, experts say, by guess what, ladies and gentlemen? Guess what in Pakistan? Anti-American sentiment? Sure. At an all-time high over there. Even as the U.S. steps up its economic and military aid, average Pakistanis continue to blame their country's woes on Washington. U.S. drone attacks on militants in the tribal areas, the ineffective U.S. aid program. Well, why would that be ineffective? It's worked. And U.S. support for controversial generals, experts say, have generated widespread anti-American feeling in Pakistan. They say U.S. support for generals behind military coups has historically been responsible for anti-American sentiment among Pakistan's people. And Pakistanis believe the U.S. has been using Pakistan's army to achieve its own objectives, as, for example, in Afghanistan. The U.S., many Pakistanis feel, is making a special effort to appease Pakistan's military since the army felt abandoned when the U.S. lost interest in the region, in the AFPAC region, following Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan in 1989. Says former U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, Wendy Chamberlain, U.S. anti-U.S. feeling began with American support for President General Zia-ul-Haq in 1979, when he overthrew the government and executed a popular elected president. And then, of course, we supported General Perv. So, making friends over there. Hearts and minds, ladies and gentlemen, hearts and minds. How much do you bid? And, also in the AFPAC file, the movie Michael... You know. British troops could end their combat role in Afghanistan even sooner than the 5 years the British government has suggested. That's according to just the British top diplomat in Afghanistan, Michael Caine. Political developments could accelerate the process leading... Political developments? Really? In a war? Could lead to a reduction in fighting and to NATO forces ending their combat in a 3 to 5 year timescale, says Sir William Patey, Britain's ambassador to Kabul. Talks leading to a political settlement should get off the ground sooner rather than later, he said, referring to contacts with Taliban elements. You know, that element. The British election cannot be held. The next British election cannot be held later, by the way, in case you're adjusting your calendar, than 2015. And, coincidentally, a Foreign Office minister, Alistair Burt, emphasized the British government's commitment to ending the combat role of British troops in Helmand Province at the latest by... Any guesses? 2015. Now you know how soon we're going to be getting out in this country, or not. Ladies and gentlemen, the worst of the worst. We got Osama's driver. Now we got his cook. A Sudanese man accused of guarding Osama bin Laden and helping him escape U.S. forces in Afghanistan pleaded guilty at Gitmo, giving the Obama administration its first conviction in the controversial war crimes court. Ibrahim Ahmad Mahmoud Al-Khozi pleaded guilty. He ran the kitchen at bin Laden's Star of Jihad compound near Jalalabad. Tom, would you want to take a crack at that? Jalalabad. All right. Good try. And he's been held at the Gitmo for more than 8 years. You may remember the driver. Forget his name, but we convicted Osama's driver. He got, I think, an extra 6 months in addition to his time served in Guantanamo. He's a free man driving somebody else now. This guy is going to be cooking for somebody soon, I think. It was a plea agreement. The terms were not disclosed, but it's unlikely he would have pleaded guilty to both charges without some limit on his sentence. So we got the cook. Now Osama's going to have to be eating MREs, Fritos. All right, in that regard, we get this week a glimpse at two interesting sets of numbers. The first, the numbers out of Guantanamo Bay. A federal judge, apropos, has ordered the release of another Yemeni captive at Guantanamo. The 37th time a war on terror captive at that prison has won an unlawful detention suit against the U.S. government. Judge Paul Friedman's order in the case of Hussein al-Murfedi instructs the administration to take all necessary and appropriate steps to facilitate the release of the petitioner. His reasoning on why the U.S. had unlawfully detained al-Murfedi, now 33, held at Guantanamo since May of 2003, of course, is still under seal. Shh, as is this broadcast. As far back as 2005, he had argued, had the detainee before a military panel, that he'd fled Yemen with plans to settle in Europe, not to join a jihad. Instead, his journey took him to Pakistan and then Tehran, where Iranian forces turned him over to Afghan forces, who in turn handed him over to the United States. Welcome to your life, babe. Justice Department attorneys argued that al-Murfedi was a former salesman of the narcotic plant called Khat, which, by the way, everybody in Yemen chews. So that makes him a bad guy, who came to support al-Qaeda and is thus an enemy of the United States. A chunk of the case file is censored in federal court. So, shh, shh, shh. But anyway, the U.S. government has so far successfully defended 14 detentions among the 181 now held. An appeals court has found a flaw in one of the 14 rulings. In contrast, civilian judges have so far found for the release of 37 so-called enemy combatants, ordered them repatriated or resettled. So 37 to 14, the detainees are leading the government. And another numerical struggle looms. The battle between victims of the flooding of New Orleans and the battle between victims of the oil spill. Here's how that lays out. The House of Representatives has voted to rescind $400 million in so-called road home money from Louisiana. That was the money the federal government had appropriated to compensate homeowners for their damages in the, what people here call the federal flood. If you want to find out why, see The Big Uneasy this August. The reason the House has rescinded the $400 million? To help offset some new emergency spending, including $300 million for the BP oil spill response. Get it? The Senate still must vote. The vote has caused state and New Orleans officials to scramble, trying to assess the impact while warning of major consequences to ongoing hurricane recovery efforts. Louisiana has spent $9.5 of the $10.3 billion the feds provided for the Road Home program. The House action would take away nearly half the remaining amount. Not being able to finish the Road Home program would affect thousands of people, says a spokeswoman for the Disaster Recovery Unit of Louisiana. The state was using portions of the remaining money to help victims of contractor fraud or malfeasance to rehabilitate damaged homes that were among the ones thousands obtained from homeowners who did not rebuild, and to assist those homeowners who had problems with contaminated Chinese drywall. The head of the House committee that voted to take the money out said the money was supposed to be spent by 2007. The state responds much of the money wasn't received by the state until the year 2000. Welcome to your nightmare, ladies and gentlemen. Hello, welcome to the show.
funky.
From the edge of Lake Pontchartrain, not the edge where the tar barrels appeared, the other edge. The edge of Lake Pontchartrain, New Orleans, Louisiana. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Is any other part of the tar edible? Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger apologized for a decision by state California transportation officials to paint over a giant American flag mural on the side of a Northern California freeway. The 35-foot-long flag was painted on a concrete slab near Interstate 680 in Sunol. You know where Sunol is, don't you? I do. By three men about 2 weeks after the 9/11 attacks on New York and Washington. Even though the mural had been in clear view of commuters for nearly 9 years, a Caltrans spokesperson said it wasn't until last month someone in the agency asked if the flag was on state property. "We don't allow graffiti on state property," said the spokesperson. And that got people mad. calling the flag graffiti. The Republican candidate for President Obama's old Senate seat in Illinois apologized last week for being careless about embellishing aspects of his Navy reservist career and promised to, quote, make sure this never happens again. Representative Mark Kirk of Illinois is attempting to restart a stalled campaign against his Democratic opponent. Apple has apologized for the issues regarding reception on its iPhone 4. The company's announcement said it would be issuing a software update soon. Apple said it was... the reports about reception issues came as a surprise to it, and it began an investigation immediately. Roger Ebert has recently apologized for his comments that video games cannot be an art after 4,500 responses. He retracted his statement when he apologized to video games fans. He said, "I was a fool for mentioning video games in the first place. I would never express an opinion on a movie I hadn't seen, yet I declared as an axiom that video games can never be art. I still believe this, but I should never have said so." And you shouldn't have said you still believe it, but... The BBC has been forced to apologize after labeling Facebook users saddos on its new 2012 Olympics website. In a column on the website promoting the British broadcaster's forthcoming Olympic coverage of social media, the holding page was prepared with a heading that said, "Follow us on Twitter. You can also become a saddo on Facebook," unquote. Under the headline, "A suitable strapline here," the premature website showed a wall of names and faces that bore little relation to each other. It seems despite the importance the BBC has put upon getting to grips with social media, somebody within the BBC still doesn't quite respect the audience it is seeking, says a media blog. Ben Gallup, the BBC's head of Sport Interactive, apologized for the error. "It was clearly a mistake, and we're looking into how a test page, came to be published. I believe someone pushed the send button, babe." As part of a settlement with Australian Privacy Commissioner, Google has apologized publicly on its official blog for inadvertently collecting personal data from unprotected wireless networks via its Street View cars, a privacy breach that has tied the search giant up in regulatory knots in dozens of countries, including the U.S., Canada, and the European Union. The public mea culpa appears to save Google from any further regulatory action in Australia, but it could face government sanctions in some of these other jurisdictions. In the apology, Google's senior vice president for engineering and research, Alan Eustace, said the company was happy that the Australian government had completed its privacy investigation and that Google was committed to working even more closely with them going forward on the privacy implications of our product launches. It said, "In addition, we want to reiterate to Australians that this was a mistake for which we are sincerely sorry." He thus becomes the first Google executive to utter those two words, "extremely sorry," on this issue. CNN this Wednesday removed its senior editor for Middle Eastern Affairs, Octavia Nazar, from her job after she published a Twitter message saying she respected the Shiite cleric, the Grand Ayatollah Mohammed Hussein Fadlallah, not enough names, babe, who died on Sunday. Nazar left her CNN office after being fired. She's a 20-year veteran of CNN, wrote on Twitter after the cleric died last week, "Sad to hear the passing of Sayed Fadlallah, one of Hezbollah's giants I respect a lot. He routinely denounced Israel in the UN and supported suicide bombings against Israeli citizens." CNN officials became aware of the message on Monday, and a spokesman said Tuesday it was an error of judgment on her part. Quote, "CNN regrets any offense her Twitter message caused. It did not meet CNN's editorial standards. This is a serious matter. It was dealt with accordingly." Her explanation... When she used a follow-up blog post, she used "respect" and "sad" because, quote, "to me, as a Middle Eastern woman, Fadlallah took a contrarian and pioneering stand among Shia clerics on women's rights. He called for the abolition of honor killing. He called the practice primitive and non-productive. This does not mean I respected him for what else he did or said. Far from it," she said from her new job search. There'll be more on that. Meanwhile, Australia's leading Catholic, Cardinal George Pell, has decided to throw his weight behind the historic apology to victims of sexual abuse offered by Archbishop Dennis Hart of Melbourne. In a statement, Cardinal Pell, the Archbishop of Sydney, said he wholeheartedly endorsed Archbishop Hart's letter of apology, which went to 219 parishes, saying the letter speaks for me too. He spoke of a crisis of faith and acknowledged that victims of clergy abuse had been betrayed. The church had not always responded properly. He said sexual abuse was an evil which has no place in the church, and those who have committed these crimes deserve the full force of the law. That Catholic priests and members of religious orders are among the worst abusers fills all Catholics, including myself, he said, with horror and disgust. The Catholic Apology of the Week, ladies and gentlemen. A new report by the Venezuelan... that goes in another place. And Britain's ambassador to Lebanon has apologized for a blog post in which she praised Lebanon's recently deceased top Shiite cleric. Frances Guy said she regretted any offense she caused after writing that she was saddened by the death of Grand Ayatollah Fadlallah. She also said in the post that the world, quote, needs more men like him willing to reach out across faiths. The British government removed the post, saying it did not reflect government policy. So leave Fadlallah alone, I guess, is the lesson here for the week. You just hate him because he played a saxophone. Caltrans has also apologized for removing that American flag mural. That's just in. Deadline LaRousse France, Carlos Barreto, and Raul Rui Costa have apologized to each other for their punch-up after Friday's sixth stage of the Tour de France. Race organizers say the matter is now closed. For me, it was never open, but that's just me. Tour organizers said before the start of the latest stage of the race that Spain's Barreto and Portugal's Costa had settled their differences. The two cyclists have apologized. They shook hands this morning. The incident is thus closed. The violent clash can't, said tour organizers, be accepted by the cycling world, unquote. Barreto charged toward Costa near the finish line and attempted to strike him over the head with a bike wheel. The pair then traded blows before grappling on the ground. I guess if you're hit on over the head with a bicycle wheel, you do need a spokesperson. Dateline Little Rock, Arkansas. Three reporters and a cameraman at a Little Rock NBC affiliate have been fired after profanity-filled spoof videos turned up on YouTube. KARK General Manager Rick Rogala apologized in a statement to viewers and said disciplinary action had been taken. The video showed the reporters using profane language and poking fun at their jobs. I don't know what's wrong with TV people. They seem so bitter. Dateline Nagoya, Japan. Dozens of stable masters and wrestlers have bowed their heads in unison to the Doyo ring to be used for the Grand Sumo Tournament in apology for an illegal gambling scandal now hitting the sumo world. I think that's all I need to say about that. The 20-year-old father of Sarah Palin's first grandchild has apologized for youthful indiscretion in criticizing the one-time Republican vice presidential nominee in TV and magazine interviews. Levi Johnston tells People magazine, last year after Bristol and I broke up, I was unhappy and a little angry. Unfortunately, against my better judgment, I publicly said things about the Palins that were not completely true. Back home in Wasilla, Alaska, meanwhile, Johnston's mother has been arrested on drug charges, pleaded guilty, and served time. What does Levi bury the feuds with the word so to the Palin family in general, to Sarah Palin in particular? Please accept my regrets and forgive my youthful indiscretion. I hope to restore your trust. He's now living in the Palin house again. And I guess an apology is cheap rent. USC has sent letters of apology to five schools that it alleged contacted freshman tailback Dylan Baxter about transferring immediately after last month's NCAA sanctions were announced. Schools can contact junior... Who cares about that? And it's USC, besides. And finally, supermodel. I don't say that word often. And I won't say it again. Elle McPherson says she regrets any distress she may have caused by jokingly advocating the use of powdered rhino horn, a traditional Chinese medicine that is banned, you know, worldwide. That's all. During a recent interview with the Sunday Times magazine in Britain, the Australian model said she had tasted rhino horn and that it had, quote, done the job. Her comments were condemned by animal rights activists, more so because she had publicly boycotted a London restaurant for serving bluefin tuna, an animal that is as endangered as is the white rhino. The model later told News.com in Australia that she had never knowingly consumed or encouraged the use or consumption of any products which contained material derived from endangered species. She said she regretted any distress or offense that a banter with an interviewer might have caused. She's in Britain hosting the TV show Britain's Next Top Rhino. Model. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, that is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And moving quickly to another one. News from outside the bubble. From The Independent on Sunday in London, the strategic plan of creating an Afghan security force to replace U.S. and British troops is in serious disarray, with local forces a fraction of their reported size, infiltrated by the Taliban at senior levels and plagued by corruption and drug addiction, according to an Independent on Sunday investigation. Less than a quarter of the army and less than 1 in 7 police units are rated as CM1, meaning they're capable of operating independently. The International Security Assistance Forces leaders acknowledge problems with local security forces. An analysis by The Independent on Sunday reveals the true strength of the Afghan security forces is barely 34,000, just about a seventh of the 236,000 claimed by NATO and the ISAF. Insurgents have been able to infiltrate Afghan security forces at senior levels. In one case, a police commander was found to have been involved in a number of indirect IED attacks on coalition forces, as well as the kidnap and murder of an American civilian. In another, a known Taliban commander was discovered serving in the Afghan army. The police are seen as a particular problem. A purge of the corruption-riddled force by the Ministry of the Interior resulted in more than 1 in 5 senior police leaders being fired or prosecuted for corruption or misconduct in the past 18 months. Barely a tenth of police units are rated effective. Some 70% of police are illiterate. Half have had no formal training. A trail of confidential correspondence between foreign office officials obtained by the newspaper highlights the concerns within the government. "We want high-quality recruits, as high quality as we can get," says one. "This means lowering the bar a lot in terms of literacy, but maintaining it in terms of the threshold on drug addiction." That's according to an official in the British Provincial Reconstruction Team. And from the same newspaper, thousands of British troops failed to reach the Army's own basic... This is British troops now, not Afghan Army troops. Failed to meet the British Army's own standards of fitness. Amid growing concerns that many British soldiers are becoming too fat to fight. Internal documents obtained by The Independent on Sunday reveal that obesity has become a significant problem in the British Army. The Ministry of Defense report into fitness levels confirms that barely two-thirds of soldiers are as fit as they should be, despite commanders' insistence that fitness is vital. Pass rates in our latest Army-wide fitness tests are way off the 90% target laid down by the chiefs, following warnings over the growing problem of obesity. Troops who fail are given a chance to retake the test, a mile-and-a-half run, sit-ups and press-ups against the clock, wearing kit and training shoes, kit meaning equipment, but if they continue to fail after remedial training, they can be discharged. The pass rate is too low. Concerned commanders blame a dearth of qualified fitness trainers, the high numbers of older or stood-down personnel, and those already on operations overseas. One officer bemoans the attitude of young recruits who are not taking responsibility for maintaining their own fitness levels. These kids today with the thing. Another paper presented to Army chiefs 2 years ago says obesity is a significant problem for the armed forces and blamed a lack of fitness for the more than 5 soldiers a day diagnosed with heat illness in Afghanistan. This, ladies and gentlemen, joins the report that we just shared with you a few weeks ago about the very same problem in the United States Army, that we, in fact, are too fat to fight.
Well, when it comes down to truculence, the truck don't stop here. I'll cuss out the bad guys at the drop of a beer. I'll talk up America till dawn's early light. Too bad that I'm too fat to fight. I joined up with the army on some kind of dare, but traveling on my stomach, it made people stare. Couldn't fit in my bunk, my camo was too tight. Turns out I was too fat to fight. That's right. Too fat to fight. It ain't it a shame? 'Cause war is really America's game. Got bellicose brains, but our varicose veins mirror all too fat to fight. We're all too fat to fight. That's right. Now the burgers and the fries, the Cokes and ice cream. Well, I thought I was eating the American dream. But when my boots disappeared clean out of my sight, I could see I was too fat to fight. Now shooting, parachuting, clean out of a plane. It's not just a job, it's a terrible strain. The few and the proud will carry our might. The rest of us are too fat to fight. That's right. Too fat to fight. And it does seem a waste, but building up nations just ain't to our taste. Got bellicose brains, but our varicose veins mean we're all too fat to fight. They're smart and they're light. God made us too fat to fight. Now one of these days my son will enlist. I'll be hiding my tears. By his mom he'll be kissed. He'll waddle on that drill field and be home by night. Like his dad, he'll be too fat. Too fat to fight, and ain't it a shame? 'Cause war is really America's game. We got bellicose brains, but our varicose veins mean we're all too fat to fight. We're all too fat to fight.
center. Don't you know about the billions raised in sight? He's picking off the whole herd as soon as we enter. So you won't mind if I kiss you now.
This is Le Show, and ladies and gentlemen, some of the big news and some of the little news coming up now. Facing mounting criticism over cost-cutting, deferred maintenance, and a corporate culture that discourages dissent, the beleaguered head of the company that runs the 800-mile-long Trans-Alaska Pipeline announced this week he's going to retire. Kevin Hostler's decision comes as two congressional subcommittees investigate the company's maintenance and safety records amid allegations that employees who expressed safety concerns were ignored or even punished. Who runs Alyeska Pipeline? Basically controlled by BP. In the 77 days since the oil began, BP has skimmed or burned about 60% of the amount it promised regulators it could remove in a single day. The disparity between what BP promised in its March 24 filing with federal regulators and the amount it's recovered underscores what some officials call a misleading numbers game that has led to widespread confusion about the extent of the spill and the progress of the recovery. In a March report that was not questioned by federal officials, BP said it had the capacity to skim and remove 491,000 barrels of oil each day in the event of a major spill. As of Monday, with about 2 million barrels released into the Gulf, the skimming operations that were touted as key to preventing environmental disaster have averaged less than 900 barrels a day. Skimming has captured only 67,000 barrels. BP has relied on burning to remove 238,000 barrels. Most of the oil recovered, 632,000, was captured directly at the site of the leaking well. BP officials declined to comment on the validity of the early skimming projections, stressing instead the company's commitment to making money elsewhere. No, sorry, I just... and confirming something I was told by one of my sources in the immediate aftermath of the Deepwater, seriously, in the immediate aftermath of the disaster, BP publicly touted its expert cleanup response while quietly girding for a legal fight that can soon embroil hundreds of attorneys. According to McClatchy newspapers, BP swiftly signed up experts who otherwise would work for plaintiffs. It presented fishermen, volunteers, and potential workers with waivers, hoping they would sign away some of their right to sue. Nice people doing nice things. Now, ladies and gentlemen, to the LeBronathon. Most of you know, I think, that there was a big TV show this week. It was the most watched TV show on Thursday night, which just proves how few people watch television in the midsummer. And it featured LeBron James, late of the Cleveland Cavaliers, filling an hour to answer the question, where are you going to play next, babe? It was an amazing broadcast. I didn't see all of it. Could a sentient human see all of it? But I did see enough to see the distinguished sports journalist. And how can one put those words together? Distinguished sports journalist Jim Gray was recruited to be the interviewer. I really thought the format was going to be, 8 minutes of dancers coming out, then LeBron does, like, a monologue. Hey, how about Cleveland? You know that river? That sort of thing. that level, too. But no, it was a sit-down interview. And it contained this question and answer segment, among others. Here's Jim Gray asking, and listen to the follow-up question, ladies and gentlemen, to hear distinguished sports journalism at work.
So does the team that you're going to, that you'll announce in a few minutes, do they know your decision?
They just found out.
They just found out.
Yeah.
So the other five, on pins and needles, they don't know. They'll be listening to this.
Right.
Well, they just found out because he told us that the team he's going to knows. So if the teams, the other five teams, didn't receive that information, now they do know, Jim. You see what I'm saying? They're not on pins and needles waiting for the TV announcement. They know they didn't hear from him. They know he's not playing for them. Smart follow-up question. Jim Gray also, it was such a long, you know, they had you there if you were watching, and there was only one thing anybody was interested in. Where is he going to play next? So, of course, Jim, distinguished sports journalist Jim Gray asks every question under the sun, it seemed, besides that, leading up to it. He even asked LeBron, was he still a nail biter? But that, ladies and gentlemen, it was worse than you thought. That was not a live broadcast. And I've, through some sources, gotten hold of some of the outtakes from that taping.
And 5, 4, 3, 2.
I did think long and hard about how I was going to introduce you here tonight, LeBron. What did you think of my introduction of you?
Well, I have enjoyed it.
Mm. Well, I'm glad. LeBron, this is a question that some of the fans sent in via Twitter tonight. Have you ever been seized by a sneezing fit when you've been on the court?
Well, certain things like that is one thing you can't control.
I know, but any number of times at all?
Let's say one. And like I said before, one thing you can't control is you never know. But I have enjoyed it.
A lot of speculation about what your contract may offer. Do you have any idea how much money you're going to be making next season?
I probably could count it on my fingers.
This is one of the biggest days of your young life. How did it start?
This morning, I woke up.
Hmm. You know, LeBron, all of us are scared of something. Have you ever run into a big, large, scary spider?
Probably in my dreams.
You still a nail biter?
I have a little bit, not of late.
Nose picker?
No.
Leg twitcher?
Like I said before, it's very tough.
Do you find yourself flossing more?
But I never thought it was possible.
You're still a young man, 25 years old. How do you feel about your future?
Well, I mean, I'm looking forward to it.
We have a Facebook question from a viewer named Sharon.
Well, for me, it's not about sharing.
Okay. You had to go through a physical examination before this whole process. How was your chest x-ray?
My heart will always be around that area.
Well, that's a good thing.
I mean, it's heartfelt for me.
Favorite social network, Twitter or Facebook?
I'm not sure.
Favorite piece of advice?
One thing my mother told me, love me for who I am.
That's great. Anything else you remember her telling you?
No one can live with you besides you.
Wow, that must have been tough to hear.
It was the relief that I was looking for throughout this whole process. It was easy.
Okay, your people are signaling, am I doing okay here?
You've raised a lot of people's expectations.
All right, let me just get some water. You okay where you're sitting?
I feel like it's time to change.
Okay, will it match? All right, we'll work on that and take a 5. And now, ladies and gentlemen, still more news of the Olympic movement. The London Organizing Committee is seeking to bring in about $300 million from the sale of 10 million tickets. Insiders say the Organizing Committee will backtrack on a promise made during the bid for the Games that all but 2 million tickets will be priced at $75 or less. Well, you want affordable tickets? Go to the Paralympics. And the London Olympic organizers will begin selling pins, they call them badges, in support of the gay community. In support, meaning they feature the rainbow flag and the London 2012 logo, and they'll be sold at the gay pride parade. But the money goes to the Olympics. You see what I'm saying? Former Wales rugby captain Gareth Thomas, who announced he was gay, complimented the organizers for attempting to achieve greater inclusion in sports. Games organizers plan to sell more pins in the next year based on other issues such as age, disability, belief, gender, and ethnicity. Polish Starbucks baristas for the Olympics. Get your pins now. It's a movement. Don't not move. And ladies and gentlemen, it's clean, it's safe, it's cheap. It's too nice to meter. It's nuclear power. Signs of leakage have turned up at a nuclear waste storage cell in Lewiston, New York, since shortly after it was built 24 years ago. Some of the federal regulators responsible for the site almost from the beginning seem to have been looking the other way, says an engineer and chemist. And Roberts, a former Town of Porter resident, has recently questioned the Army Corps of Engineers on its monitoring of the radiological waste buried in a 10-acre cell in Lewiston. She believes the cell is leaking and wants to know why officials deny it's happening, even though nuclear waste materials have been found outside of it. If you can't find contamination, Roberts said at a public meeting, you don't stop measuring, but federal regulators in some sections of the site did just that. Speaking of the Army Corps, Congressman Jim Cooper of Nashville, Tennessee, finds it troubling that there was such a lack of communication and information coming from the Corps during the May weekend in which Nashville experienced extreme flooding from the Cumberland River. You shouldn't have to have a dad in the Corps in Washington to tell you how to save your own neck, he says, recounting an experience in his own family. He finds it utterly staggering that no one had any notice about how quickly the water was rising and that there were no warnings to evacuate. The water rose 10 feet in 16 hours. Metro Nashville lost 80 buses. With an hour to a warning, we might have been able to save those buses. Nobody had any warning. This is spooky. If anybody had any idea it was going up 19 feet, maybe they should have told somebody, said the congressman. He's frustrated about what he's learned of the Corps' response during the natural disaster, not to mention its handling of subsequent inquiries and the way it's chosen to brief elected officials. You know, he says, they fly these lieutenant colonels in here every 2 years. The Corps' Nashville district commander, he says, is a perfectly nice man, but he's had zero water management experience, and then he gets hit with the flood of the century. I really do feel sorry for him. There should be a Corps booklet on how to handle these things. The Corps may perform a comprehensive post-disaster report. That's still in the funding approval stages. It may have been requested only because of pressure from the congressman. Before that, it appears the Corps was perfectly satisfied to publish only a perfunctory pro forma kind of report. The flooding was so severe, a dead horse was found in a tree. Water rose a full 25 feet over homes in an adjacent county. It makes it devilish to figure out what they're talking about, says Cooper of the Army Corps' way of doing things. When we were briefed a month ago, they said, after action report, well, I thought that was the big deal, the full deal. I had no idea that a post-flood report meant something bigger and stronger and better. You shouldn't have to play 20 questions with these guys. Lieutenant Colonel Mitchell, the local commander, said, quote, when you're in that flood fight and things are happening so fast, the pools are rising so quickly, and you've got phone calls and requests and the media and all this, and you're trying to control the river at the same time, you're acting as best you can, you're human, unquote. If you're curious as to whether that's standard operating procedure for the Army Corps of Engineers, you'll be enlightened by the Big Uneasy coming soon. It's a movie. Nutty thing is, we here at the Le Show Dome are human too. And we didn't cause any flooding. Ladies and gentlemen, not that I know of. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the East Coast, firing the North American shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, available. Did I say the mighty 104 in Berlin? Yes, I did. Available on your smartphone through Stitcher.com. Available as a free download to members at audible.com/LeShow. Available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And available someplace else I'm going to find out about later today. And it'll be just like us all being human. If you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty. Thank you very much. Tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago in exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks to Bob Dunn here at WWNO-FM for helping to make today's program a tenuous reality. And thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The tipitlish, email address for this broadcast and playlist of music heard here on always available at harryshearer.com. The show is on Twitter, just so close to 10,000 followers. Come on! Get in on the fun at Le Twits. And there's no fun. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica. It's a community recognized around the world as the home. Say it with me now. Of the homeless.